This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark AmTower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. AmTower Off-Center with your host, Mark AmTower.
Welcome to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I am Mark AmTower. My guest today is the one, the only, Guy Timberlake. Guy, welcome back, man.
Mark, good to be here. Good to see you.
Been too long. Guy is the president, CEO, chief visionary of the American Small Business Coalition. You can find him at theasbc.com and on LinkedIn and speaking at a variety of events, his own and others. So let's start off with my all-time favorite contract, Soup 5. Word on the street is it's not official yet, but May 1 should be the actual rollout date finally. So we're talking about Group A with 36, Group B with 42, Group C with 80. Mm-hmm. Count them, 80, and Group D with 48. So total count, not deduped, is over 200, more than six times. What is that? Five times. Soup 4.
So I mean, if these are good numbers, I mean that's a significant bump up in the approved pool, if you will, for what's going to play on Soup. And so, you know, Mark, you and I were talking on the way in. One of the big challenges with the GWACs, the IDIQs, and all the various contract vehicles out there is it's great to get a spot. You know, it's great to get a seat. I mean, that's your ticket to the dance. What are you going to do once you get there?
Yeah, and I don't mean to belittle anybody that won, except maybe a couple of the protesters who weaseled in. Did I say that out loud?
You were just thinking that.
just one of those thoughts. But you know, it is. It's like GSA schedule, and you know, I'm talking to a company on 56 after I leave here today. And they're doing pretty good on 56. But, you know, once again, scrolling through SSQ, I see time after time, you know, the $0, right, the few dollars, and the companies that have been there for 3 or 4 years who aren't doing anything with it. You're going to lose it because GSA is cutting you off.
Yeah, they've bumped up their scrutiny and their release of those companies. I mean, the bottom line, I told companies years ago, and if you talk to my friend Courtney Fairchild over Global Services, mm-hmm, the bottom line, there's an administrative cost to the government to have those contracts there, even if they're doing nothing.
Right. There is an administrative cost. And, you know, Richard Mackey pretty much started the list for me 10 years or so ago now. So we've been tracking it for a long time. The top 5% in any schedule category is taking better than 60% of the dollars. And I don't care which schedule category we're talking about.
It's the federal supply schedule Pareto principle. It's what it comes down to.
Yeah. But the bottom line is all of those companies that go through that horrific process of getting a schedule,
right,
and then not leveraging it.
Well, why would you go through all that pain and suffering just to sit there and watch it get taken away?
Right. So the same thing applies to Soup. Yes, you can submit a bid and you can protest and you can get on, but you can't whine your way to a task order.
Well, there are basically
like
things.
Line.
Absolutely, that's a good one. Well, I mean, there are all the things that, you know, everyone talks about. You and I and others talk about all the time. There are some fundamentals that have to be in place. And if they're not in place when you get the contract, that should be job one, is to develop those relationships, that institutional knowledge, you know, what is the culture of the organization or organizations you're going to work with. You know, luckily with Soup, it's a GWAC, so it's government-wide. It's not just doing business with NASA. It's doing business with any agency that chooses to use the vehicle. So the good news is a lot of people use it. The bad news is a lot of people use it. You've got to go out there and basically carve out your niche.
Yeah, and for some of the companies on it, I mean, last in Soup 4, there were, what, about 42 thereabouts. I forget the, I think that's close to the exact number. But there wasn't a bum in the lot.
Right.
Everybody made money from the contract. Obviously, some more than others, but everybody produced.
Right.
You know, in, was it 4 years ago or so, I spoke at the Soup conference. I keynoted.
Yep.
And it was like going to Old Home Week. It wasn't just the contractors and the staff. It was all of the people from the agencies, you know, NASA, Air Force, USD, you know, all of these people. Everybody seemed to know each other. I was kind of the odd man out.
Sure.
But they, you know, they took me under their wing and we went to Stubbs. And but it was a wonderful conference. Tons and tons of great information.
Well, now, you know, when you look at, you know, again, these numbers being correct, and you look at the award pool, you have to start wondering if this is going to start looking more like GSA Stars 2. You know, one of the big issues there, and I think I mentioned the last time I looked at the numbers on Stars 2, out of all the vendors that are left on Stars 2, fewer than, I think it was roughly 50%, may have been fewer than 50% have any dollars against
any
Stars
dollars.
2.
And there were, what, 599 awardees on Stars?
Exactly. No, well, no, and it's, I think there's been some attrition, you know, based on that as well. But,
oh, gee, I'm surprised.
Exactly. But the whole point is, I mean, we know a lot of the companies who have the Stars 2 vehicle, and there may be some very valid reasons that companies don't have business right now, but Stars 2, I mean, as far as I'm concerned and what I understand, is a successful vehicle. You know, agencies are using it. It doesn't, I mean, I think if you look spend for spend, it's not far off from what Stars was doing overall, but you just got a lot more companies involved now than you did on the original contract.
Well, yeah, but you know, let's talk about a couple of other vehicles then. Eagle has a nice set aside component.
Right.
Do we know anything about the numbers there?
Don't know. I need to go look and pull those down. I'm going to do this actually for a few of the contracts out there because I've had people ask me about this just from a performance standpoint. You know, one of the things that we try to do is, you know, a lot of the companies we work with, we'll pull a little bit of intelligence just to, you know, show them some of the trends on different vehicles. You know, who are the companies that are performing? Who they're doing business with? That type of thing. Eagle's pretty easy. It's one agency. So
Right. You're
not really worried about too many other agencies.
But it's,
you know,
a pretty significant
in.
Agency.
Absolutely significant agency. So I don't know what the trend looks like there as far as who's performing, who's not performing. You know, if they're, you know, what to what extent the Pareto principle applies to Eagle.
Okay. What about Alliant?
Alliant and Alliant Small Business are interesting in that again, there's visibility. There's definitely work going to those vehicles. I don't know if it's what GSA anticipated. So I don't know if they're high or low on what their projections were. So the companies that are doing well on a line are doing well, and those that aren't, they're not.
And you know, but you know, it's not brain surgery. If you see if you know enough to do the research to see who's doing well, you can look at their website
right. And
intuit some of the things that they are doing well. Are they putting out webinars? Are they doing case studies? You know, Market Connections came out with a new study just a week or so ago, and I'll have Lisa DeZutti on in a few weeks to talk about it. But, you know, there's a disconnect between the types of information that the vendors want to produce and the government absorbs.
Right.
One of the number one or number two are case studies and white papers.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, this is old school stuff.
Right.
But it helps people make buying decisions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, again, I mean, so part of the disconnect is for a lot of the companies who get these contract vehicles. I mean, I guess for me, the old days, you know, it used to be if you're going after a contract like that, you pretty much had a foothold, you know, in that organization. I mean, I'm talking going back to, you know, the old, you know, Falcon and, you know, Pulsar day to days and things like that back when I was, you know, with the whole Beltway Bandit crowd.
Right.
And so it was the old, you know, the Air Force desktop contracts, things like that. But you didn't really win those contracts if you didn't have something to bring to the table. I mean, that's just how things were written, how they were put together. You know, one of my chief complaints is, unfortunately, it seems to me anyway, that the government has kind of succumbed to the protest to win methodology, which is, you know, somebody protests, let's just kind of placate and, you know, give them a spot in the contract to shut them up, and, you know, hopefully they'll go away or just, you know, no longer shout from the rooftop.
Yeah, and it's a shame, but it's a reality of the market. We're going to take our first break. I'm Mark Amtower. You're listening to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'll be back with Guy after these messages. Welcome back to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower because nobody else volunteered. My guest today is Guy Timberlake of the American Small Business Coalition. Again, you can find Guy at theasbc.com. It is .com.
.com and .org.
Yep. And .org, both of them. I thought so. And you can find him on LinkedIn. There is only one Guy Timberlake on LinkedIn.
A lot of people say fortunately, too.
Yeah, well, there's that. But there's, you know, same thing with yours truly. There's only one of me on LinkedIn, and you're stuck with it. let's wrap up on the contracts, particularly the contracts attractive to small biz.
Mm-hmm.
What are we missing here?
I mean, think, you know, from just a general advice standpoint, I mean, there's a level of vetting. There's a level of due diligence that companies, especially small companies, need to put in place when they're looking at any vehicle, whether it's a GSA schedule, they're being considered for a BPA with an agency, whether it's a GSA BPA, a simplified acquisition BPA, or a competitive BPA. They need to really think about the investment that they're going to make to get that award, and then what is the potential return, and how are they going to work to amplify those returns? Are they going to be willing to put in the due diligence, the level of effort to market the vehicle, to reach out and establish, you know, lines of communication with the viable customers, understand how the vehicle can be used and so forth? I know companies who have contract vehicles have never reviewed the marketing information on the vehicles to understand, for example, who can use it. You know, they have a BPA with, you know, an agency. They don't understand it's only limited to this organization, or it could be agency wide. Mm-hmm. And so those are some of the important things a lot of companies need to really, you know, focus on. But contract vehicles being what they are, they account, you know, as of the last few fiscal years, for 50% of the reported spend by the government. If you look at FPDS, Federal Procurement Data System, and, you know, pull up the award IDV comparison, you know, 50% of the dollars obligated by the U.S. government last year and the year before went to BOAs, BPAs, GWACs, IDIQs, and the GSA schedule. So what that means is, if you don't have one of those vehicles, then you really need to focus your intent on getting partnered on one of those.
And how does one go about getting partnered on one of those?
And therein lies the challenge.
Through the channel, you know, if you have the right partner, so Carisoft, MX, DLT, if you're a reseller,
right,
you can leverage their various contracts. Aero, prior to purchasing IMIX,
right,
had a GSA schedule and six cooperative purchasing, you know, state and local gigs.
And now they got a bunch.
They just add just a few with the purchase of IMIX. So you have that. But that, you know, not everybody is a channel player. So who
exactly?
What do the other guys do?
Well, and so outside of the channel, I mean, then you're looking at, you know, really some more of the traditional partner activity. You're trying to, if you want to be a teaming partner, you're trying to find a good fit. And it's not about reaching out to a company to see what kind of work they have for you, because if you ask the average business owner what they have for somebody else, they're going to tell you, you know, zip, zah, nada, zilch, there's nothing there. You know, I don't need to do that. So when you look at, you know, why to partner, you know, or how to partner, you have to look at why. You have to look at what the value add is. You know, what is it that you can bring to the table? You know, is it a relationship? Is it a, you know, very specific capability? Is it some intelligence you've got on the customer and the opportunity? There's got to be something there. I honestly don't know of that many companies, if any, who are just arbitrarily giving away business to companies because they show up and say, I want to be your teaming partner.
I don't think it's ever happened. I'll tell you one interesting point there. I had Ed Swallow on when he was still over at Northrop, and he threw out a teaming arrangement that I had not considered before. He said, if the company has a geographic location that is key to the event, and we don't, then they're very attractive to
us. Absolutely. Well, I mean, and Mark, I mean, it was years ago, and back, you know, before Input was, you know, was brought in under the fold of Dell Tech. You know, Kevin Plexico and the folks over there used to do some really good focus groups, and they would talk
but
with
they don't
groups
anymore.
Of, I think, yeah. I don't know what they do now, per se, in that line, but no, this one in particular, they did a pretty comprehensive study and talked to a lot of companies, primarily large companies. But the focus of one of the reports had to do with the actual reasons that a large prime would partner with a small business. And it was basically clues that a company could use to understand, you know, essentially why I might have an opportunity to work with you. So it was a really, really good study. I had a chance to participate in that and be part of some of the meetings. But the nutshell really came down to, you know, what do you bring to the table? And it's not about bringing an opportunity to the table. That's what you hear a lot of times now. For, you know, you talk to a prime. Well, great, if you bring an opportunity to us, we'll, you know, we'll work with you. Well, if I bring an opportunity to the table, I don't need you. So it's not about me bringing work to the table. So let me work with you to develop opportunities. And I think that's part of the approach that a lot of folks need to really keep in mind. Again, if you want to be a partner to a company and they've already developed the opportunity, unless you bring something that is uniquely different from what they do and absolutely necessary to the fulfillment of the contract, they're probably not going to have a need for you. And
right.
It's not about checking boxes for socioeconomics. I mean, sorry. I mean, just the truth of it is, yeah, there are some large companies that do it just so that they stay compliant, especially in this day and age of agencies now penalizing companies on recompetes. So we've seen that too. But there's got to be something more to it than just the fact that you're a pretty face, you've got a checkbox socioeconomic designation. You know, how do you actually want to contribute?
Well, yeah, and the contribution side is kind of after the fact. The differentiation side is up front, and most companies still don't grasp.
Right.
I don't understand why they don't, because, you know, if you want to team with a company, and we'll get into teaming in a little more detail in just a second. If you want to team with somebody, that you've got to be on their radar.
Right.
You have to bring an extraordinary value in A or multiple categories, you know, column A, column B, column C, whatever, to the table. But you have to be on their radar.
Well, and also that value that you bring to the table has to be their perception of value and not yours.
Yep.
And that's the kicker. I mean, a lot of companies, and, you know, as a business owner, I know I have a lot of pride of authorship, and, you know, what we do and how we do it doesn't mean the guy sitting across from the table is going to value it the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if people valued it the same way we did, we'd be, you know, we'd own islands.
We'd
down
be Bill Gates.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. But that's beside the point. So let's take a little deeper dive into teaming. I shot you an article the other day.
Yes.
And I'll preface this by saying a couple of years ago, I saw a court case where a teaming partner actually took a prime to court and won.
Yes.
But this is a rarity. Why?
So that article, which was put out by an attorney, brought up some interesting points, and they offered some, I'll call it advice, that companies, small businesses should keep in mind when they're developing these teaming agreements. And, you know, the one part that they said that I really liked is, don't base your agreements, especially teaming agreements, on a form you found on the internet. Sorry. I mean, it still happens. I know it happens. You really need to have something written for your company that is, you know, specific to, you know, your locale, you know, where's the jurisdiction going to be for that, and whatever other specifics were there. So that was, I completely agreed with that. There were some other points that they brought up that, based on my understanding of reality, just wouldn't work. And one of the ones I saw out there had to do with, you know, ensuring that the teaming agreement spells out work share, specifically attributed to, you know, task areas on the contract and so forth. So let's just talk about big versus small. You know, let's just talk about a small company negotiating with a Lockheed Martin or a CACI or someone like that. I mean, again, unless you are that company that is bringing something to the table that is critical to their need of delivering that against that contract, I just don't see it happening.
Well, what the advice in the article was, put it in, you know, handcuffs. If we win this contract, this is how much business I expect to get from it, or not expect. This is how much business I will get from it.
Right.
So if you've ever watched Shark Tank and you've seen Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful,
right.
if you don't like his deal, you know, you're sitting across from the, you know, you're the 20-person company, you're sitting across from you know, Lockheed,
yep,
on the table. And you say, no, this is what's going to be in this agreement. And O'Leary looks at you and goes, you're dead to me. Get out of here.
No, and look, I mean, I've been in the room when that's happened before. You know, I mean, I've tried over the years when I was working for small companies to strong-arm someone because we thought our position was much more than what it was. And, you know, the result of something like that typically is they get up from the table and go back to their jobs and do their work. And that's in the discussion.
There's very few small companies in any market, much less our market, that own such a unique position that they can demand things. And that was the part of the agreement. We're going to take a break here. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'll be back with Guy after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest is Guy Timberlake of the American Small Business Coalition. Guy, so wrap up on the teaming thing. What do companies do to identify the potential, the possibility of any sort of opportunity like that?
Well, I mean, and when you're looking at trying to find partners to work with, you know, honestly, the same tactics that a company would or should use to find direct business are the best. And that kind of goes into an article you and I talked about, I put out last week, 3 tips to maximize federal sector investments. It was a follow-on to some discussions I've had with companies recently about the things that they are doing and aren't doing relative to developing intelligence, competitive intelligence, you know, what's the information management that they're doing to really position themselves. And, you know, in a nutshell, you know, I still stand my ground that a lot of companies just don't do it. They just don't have a basic process in place for going out and getting information that they can use to consume and digest that will help them make good decisions about potential partners, about viable opportunities. And so a lot of it really starts with, you know, at the beginning, why are you here? What is it you're trying to accomplish? You know, what is your offering and how is it used? And from there, and that's kind of the who, what, where, when, why, and how of, you know, defining your market. And there's, you know, the information, Mark, you know, and you and I have talked about this for years. Information related to doing business in this town is pervasive. I mean, it is just massive amounts of data that the U.S. government is publishing, that, you know, non-government entities are publishing, that is available for free on the internet, you know, then couple that with the networking meetings and developing relationships and everything else, you can really do a lot of, I'll say, viable due diligence before you start really expending any political capital or actual capital and going after work.
Okay, but the you know, focusing on, number one, defining your niche, focusing on one or two agencies, especially for smaller companies.
Right.
So ferreting down the agencies. How do they select how do they determine which agencies are going to be best for them?
Well, and I mean, you know, one of the things that I tell companies is, you have to really understand your offering. Before you get started doing anything, you have to build your offering and understand what it is you intend to sell to the U.S. government directly or indirectly. And what I find a lot of times is a lot of companies, you know, they come with these labor categories and I can do these kind of positions and so forth. Well, that's great. But if this is your first, you know, first time in this particular rodeo, when you're going out, you're selling you. And so what are you, you know, as a billable asset, billable resource, what are you and how do you position that? You know, how do you develop that labor category that's going to represent what you're going to do? But basically, you have to understand what you're trying to sell, and then you have to start digging into, great, now, who is it that buys what I sell? What experience do I bring to the table? If I was working in healthcare, in the commercial place, in commercial sector, or at the state level, then it's probably logical to assume that you're going to probably have better success looking at healthcare organizations at the federal side. If you were working with law enforcement, you know, at the state level or commercially, then I would probably line my, you know, arrows in that direction because your products and or services are probably going to be attuned to those organizations. Plus, you're going to probably know the lingo that they speak. And so you now become more of a viable cultural fit and technical fit to be able to talk to them. So basically, I think it comes into one, you know, based on the work you've done previously. I mean, everybody has something in their past before they get to government contracting that they have done. They either worked for the government, they were a contractor, they sold something to certain types of organizations, even if it wasn't a segment of the industry like healthcare or law enforcement. Think about organizations you supported and the functions that they performed in an organization. If it was a CIO organization or CTO organization, then map out the CIO organizations in some of the agencies and see which ones look a lot like or perform some of the same duties as the organizations that you worked with in the commercial side. And again, it comes into, you know, being able to speak some of the same language.
Speaking the languages is absolutely key. So I want to dive into your article a bit. There's three main segments here. Define who, what, where, when, why, and how for prospects. You know, that sounds like the old newspaper formula, man. But it works.
It works. I mean, it's sometimes back to basics is the key. And again, I think, you know I have a tendency to do this. I tend to overanalyze things, overthink things. You know, it's just kind of my nature. But a lot of times, and what I have found, you know, in the last 10 years especially, when you just get back to basics and think things through, it provides a lot of clarity.
Okay. So let's talk about you sort of did this. Who buys what you sell?
Mm-hmm.
why they buy it? Are you tying this into mission here? Or?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and mission is critical. I mean, the bottom line is, if you don't understand who an organization is, in other words, what is their contribution to the United States? I mean, if you're working with a government agency, you're working with the United States. And, you know, I tell people all the time, you need to understand big picture, what does that agency do? Some of the services that agencies provide are services to citizens. Some of them are services to companies or industry. And some of them are services to other agencies, quite honestly. And so you need to understand which of those categories are you tying into. When you talk about, you know, information technology, for example, IT obviously is the biggest, you know, or one of the biggest areas of spend for the government. You know, if you go on the IT dashboard right now, they'll tell you that of, you know, for major investments this year, there's $78 billion that they're planning to spend during fiscal year 2015. And you can drill down in there and see a lot of detail about what's going on. You know, but again, the premise being that IT being what it is, one of the things they do within the Exhibit 300s is they have service areas. They call that the business reference model. And the business reference model basically is a classification that is used as part of the federal enterprise architecture to define the types of services being provided under a certain type of investment. Investment being key code for program. And so you may see things like logistics or personnel or healthcare administration inside, you know, one of the HHS organizations. And it basically tells you, again, how this is aligned, you know, what part of the organization it is that organization or mission it's supporting. So if you don't understand why an agency does things and how they do things, it's very unlikely you're going to really have a lot of success trying to win business without being able to demonstrate some knowledge.
Okay. So the how they buy is covered there, how much they buy. These things are trackable through a variety of tools.
Absolutely. All public sources. I mean, look, folks, you know, you can buy information if you like, and that's one way to do it. But again, information being what it is, Uncle Sam publishes crazy amounts of data every day and makes it available on public websites that they host. And you can pull down information that will tell you, starting at the department level down to a contracting office level, what they spend, why they spend, how much they spend, how they competed, what vehicles they use, or what non-vehicles they use. Some of what the government spends is not against an indefinite delivery vehicle. Some of it is on standalone contracts.
Right.
And so those are the things that you need to understand. And that will very specifically give you an idea of what your approach should be going into that agency. If you don't have a BOA, a GSA schedule, a GWAC, or an IDIQ, and you see an agency spending all of its money on delivery orders, I can tell you, you don't have a shot of going direct right now unless you're going to get one of those vehicles, which means if that's how they spend their money, you need to find a partner. Okay. Back to the teaming thing.
Yeah. And how the buyer describes it, there's obviously the NAICS code.
Absolutely.
But if you don't know your PSC or SIN, how much could you possibly miss?
Well, and this is the whole thing. I mean, everyone, I won't say everyone, a lot of folks don't understand the NAICS codes and how they're used by the government. And there are multiple purposes for NAICS codes in the big picture. I mean, one is obviously in industry, companies use NAICS codes to describe their offering, describe what they do.
Right.
It also attaches to the size standard for an opportunity, you know, subcontracting and direct contracting. But generally speaking, the NAICS code indicates how the government is going to use a product or service they are buying. So if you're looking to find out what an agency is buying, then you need to use the product service code, which is the old system that DOD used to use before the NAICS codes came online. And if you look on FedBizOps in the lower right corner, you'll see that there are two different classification numbers there. The one on the bottom is the NAICS. The one right above it, called a classification code, is the reference to the product service code. And then if you look in the federal procurement data system, every action in there will have not only a NAICS code attached to it, it will have a product and service code, which tells you the primary product or service they bought on that particular contract.
Okay, we're going to wrap up after this break. My guest today is Guy Timberlake from the American Small Business Coalition. I'm Mark Amtower. You're listening to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Back after this. Welcome back to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is Guy Timberlake of the American Small Business Coalition. Guy, tell people where they can find this article we're talking about, please.
Absolutely, yeah. This is one it's called Three Tips to Maximize Federal Sector Investments, and it's on our news channel, news website, where we curate information. It's called govconchannel.com.
Okay, cool. So, so we're done with the who, what, where, when, how. Two-way visibility is step number two.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the visibility factor, the findability factor are absolutely critical.
Exactly
here.
Right. Mark, I wrote an article a few months back, one of my blogs. It talked about a company who was had been working with Bureau of Prisons for 20 years, doing a very specific type of work. And one of the prisons came out with a requirement. That was exactly what this company did. It was down the road from where they were based, down in South Carolina. And that company had never worked with that particular institution before, but another one in the area. But in the nutshell was, it was an article that Stephen Coprince had written about a protest that was lodged. The company didn't know about the opportunity, saw it got awarded, contacted the prison, and filed a protest saying it should have been a small business set-aside. Well, the contracting officer basically said, we did our due diligence. It was a simplified acquisition level purchase under $150,000, and in this case, less than $25,000. And they went out, did their market survey, looked for companies. This company wasn't listed. All right, they couldn't find them in SAM or this SBA Dynamic Small Business Search.
Holy crap.
So, and when they did, they didn't have any of the NAICS codes or PSC codes, which is why they couldn't find them, is what happened. The agency went out using product service codes, I believe, to look for what they wanted to buy and couldn't find them. So they made an award to a large company. So anyway, the protest got denied. But the point is, this company had literally 20 years of past performance with Bureau of Prisons providing this exact service. And they weren't visible. And so the point being, and Mark, this is kind of where I do the handoff to you. You know, you taught me years and years ago about visibility, the whole marketing thing. And now it's, you know, it's taken a change. Now we have LinkedIn and Twitter and all these types of things. And you're now still espousing to people what they need to do there. So it's a combination of, one, having awareness. It's so you know what's going on, situational awareness. But it's also exactly what you said. It's findability. Do you make it easy for the government or other contractors to find you based on what they're looking for?
Yeah, and it is not brain surgery by any stretch of the imagination, but it does take some work, and it definitely takes some planning.
Absolutely.
Content marketing is huge right now, but there's several different kinds of content. There is the, and all of it should be educational, but there's educational before the process begins, educating buyers on what is out there and how it's used. Mm-hmm. Once you smell an RFI beginning to brew, you develop a type of content that's very specific to that particular request for information and soon request for proposal.
Right.
You're positioning yourself as a player in that arena.
Mm-hmm.
As the award goes to final stages, you're still putting out that information. You're demonstrating an area of expertise. But if you're not findable, you know, heck with you.
Absolutely. Well, and again, it's when I go into SAM profiles for a lot of companies, and what I see a lot of the same thing. I mean, they got a few NAICS codes in there or a lot of NAICS codes. And by the way, the whole thing about too many NAICS codes is kind of a myth. I'm seeing that for myself, and I'm told that by the government as well. But also, they don't have any product service codes listed. And I will tell you that if you don't incorporate this, both of these classification systems into how you market yourself and how you conduct market research, you're only seeing a partial picture.
Okay. Now, does SIN apply to that as well?
Well,
but only if you're selling off schedule.
Well, if you're selling off schedule, absolutely. And but again, every GSA schedule is assigned a NAICS code. So your NAICS code, again, comes into play. Every action that goes against a contract vehicle, you know, will have it'll use the NAICS code applied to the vehicle at time of the award.
Mm.
So every purchase against the GSA schedule, if you look in the Federal Procurement Data System, you'll see the IDV NAICS code, the Indefinite Delivery Vehicle NAICS code. And again, it will represent the NAICS code assigned to the vehicle. I don't know if the agency can change that on a per-order basis, but again, keep in mind, the NAICS code is not necessarily what the agency is buying. It's why they're buying. It's what they plan to use the product or service for. So it's a slightly different approach, if you will, in when you consider how you use NAICS codes. Again, companies use these to market themselves, to indicate who they are, what they do, and that's absolutely appropriate. But one of the things I tell people is, you know, I was talking to a company the other day, and they do publishing. Small press, you know, books, documents, things of that nature. And they're looking specifically for purchases by the government when they reference a publication NAICS code. But I said, well, why not look for the publication product service code or the books or documents, because those PSC codes can be used across a spectrum of NAICS codes. I mean, if you look at, you know, 541519 as a NAICS code, I think computer-related services, there were 139 different product service codes attributed to that NAICS code during FY14 for billions of dollars. So the point is, there are far more product service codes out there, and they get applied. If you do program management, does program management automatically mean it's going to be for an IT program? No. You can do program management on an aviation program, construction project, you know, event planning, you name it. So the product service codes get assigned, again, based on what the government wants to buy, and then they attribute it to the NAICS code that corresponds to the purpose of that acquisition.
Okay. We only have a couple of minutes left, but I want to touch on a couple of things here. The final point of the article is develop and maintain situational awareness.
Absolutely.
And briefly describe that, please.
Well, the bottom line is this. If you don't know what's going on, I mean, obviously, if you don't know what's going on in your business, then you don't have control and you can't really be an effective organization, you know, competitor, partner, all those things. But as important as it is to understand what's going on inside the four walls of your company is understanding what's going on outside of your company that could potentially pose an opportunity or threat. And so situational awareness is the ability to understand and learn from information about what's going on outside. I mean, bottom line, if you have awareness of what's going on in a certain agency and an opportunity pops up, well, if you don't have awareness, you're not going to know about the opportunity and you're not going to have a chance to respond to it, which could have put money in the bank for you. At the same time, if there's a threat, whether it's a company, policy change, something like that, that may impact how you do business. If you're not cognizant of what's going on, I mean, the simple, you know, response is you're toast.
Right.
And so that is, you know, ultimately all of this ties into how companies develop and use competitive intelligence. And that's a whole other discussion.
Okay. I do want to last item. You do a lot on simplified acquisition.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about there because I think it represents great opportunity for small companies. Whether you're a veteran of the business or you're brand new to the business, bottom line, you know, it's smaller amounts often, which means lower risk for you and the government. So it's a lot of times a great way to get your foot in the door. One of the things that I've done is I've put a short video, about 20 minutes long, up on our Vimeo page and also on LinkedIn. And the title of it is 15 Reasons We Call These Opportunities Low-Hanging Fruit. And it basically points out the top 15 reasons that a company, especially a small business, would want to consider these. Now, one of the points I make is, one, obviously, they're inherently, you know, reserved for small business. A lot of perks there. Small companies take better than 50% of these dollars each year. In the last five fiscal years, according to the Federal Procurement Data System, the U.S. government has gone from spending $540 billion a year in FY10 to spending $443 billion last fiscal year. So a $100 billion decrease. But if you look at the spending under simplified acquisitions during that same period, in FY10, we were just under $14 billion. In FY14, we were just over $19 billion. So essentially, there's been a $1 billion increase per year on average in spending under simplified acquisition. So it's about a little under 4.5 cents of every dollar spent by the government was a simplified acquisition. So that's it's, you know, and most of those dollars are not spent against contract vehicles. They're spent on non-IDVs or standalone contracts. Purchase orders, number one, and then definitive contracts. So the cost of entry for companies is a lot less. You don't need a contract vehicle to go after most of those dollars. But the video, if you go to govconchannel.com, is on the left side. You'll see the title 15 Reasons. Take a look at it. You know, give me your feedback, but there's a lot of good information there.
Always is a lot of good information. Guy, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
This is not my day job. If you do need help on the marketing side of your vehicle, several things that we were talking about today, that visibility factor, that differentiation factor, leveraging the social media or traditional media for that matter, anything to do with the marketing side, give me a call. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net. And thank you again for listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off-Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.